The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good evening. So the topic that I thought about talking about this evening is impermanence. This is an encouragement in the Buddha's teachings. Over and over again, he encouraged us to check in and become aware of the impermanent nature of experience, of the impermanent nature of everything that is happening around us. And he did this partly because he understood through his own experience, his own understanding that we have a habit in our minds, we have a deep kind of very human habit, actually, a very deeply ingrained human habit to look out at the world and to interpret it as being very solid, stable, lasting. And then when we are confronted by the fact that things aren't stable and solid and lasting, we feel a variety of ways. In some ways, we often do struggle with this truth of impermanence. We might feel betrayed by the world. How could this be? How could the world betray me in this way? How could it not stay stable? On a recent retreat, somebody had an event happen in their life. And we were talking about impermanence in the retreat, and this person said, you know, this was actually an area that I thought was, and I know it's not really stable, but I thought it was more or less stable. And that, you know, so that's another way that we attribute permanence to things. It's like, well, yeah, I mean, I know that things are impermanent, but, you know, it's not like this is going to go away tomorrow. So we interpret things as being more or less stable. So we can sometimes feel betrayed by the world, or we can feel like we've somehow blown it, like we've been at fault. We didn't do it right because we couldn't make it the way we wanted it. We couldn't make it stable. Rather than understanding or seeing that this is just the nature of reality, essentially, the nature of reality, that is, it is impermanent, it is unstable at so many different levels. At the cosmic level, things are extremely unstable on a very long time frame, and yet, you know, we do know that our planet will not be here some billions of years from now. We know that especially in California, we know that the crust of our Earth is not stable. We know that it shifts and produces earthquakes, tsunamis, and these things create instability in our lives. And so we know these things. At some level, we know things. And so on the vast scales, we know these things. On the day-to-day scale, we know these things. We know how things change through the course of a day. We know that the sun rises and the sun sets, that the shadows change during the day. We know that we age. We know our bodies change. And yet, you know, often again, there's this way sometimes when something happens, and especially as we age and our bodies start doing their thing, decaying and not functioning the way they used to. We fight that, and you know, it's not inherently a problem to go to the doctor and get medicine and try to have, you know, your health. That is not, I'm not saying that we should just sit here and let our bodies decay and never feed ourselves or go to the doctor. But we do I think try. There's a way in which we feel like we should be able to fix things sometimes. That we should be able to get rid of this illness or fix this this problem. And sometimes we can. Sometimes there are ways that we can engage with conditions and shape things in a direction that will be to our liking for a period of time, but only for a period of time. And this is what the Buddha was pointing to really contemplate that whatever has come together based on conditions, when conditions change, things fall apart. And so he really encouraged us to reflect on this at these many different levels. And so I just want to do a little bit of a reflection about this with you this evening and hopefully point out a little bit about how and why it can be helpful for us in our lives. I mean, partly I think one of the big takeaways is that it's helpful to just realize that this impermanence is not your fault. When things change, it's just the nature of things. Taking in impermanence, as I said, we all know this, that things change. At some level, we know that things change. But there's a way in which we don't know it deeply, I would say. And there's an ancient story that reflects this. There's a famous kind of epic Indian poem from the Hindu tradition, I believe, called the Mahabharata. And in this story, there's this one reflection. A character is asked at one point. One of the characters in the story is asked by a deity, basically. He's kind of wandering through the wilderness and he's hearing voices, and this deity asks him, "What is the most amazing thing?" And his response is that every man or woman, that everyone must one day die, yet everyone lives as if they were immortal. This is the most amazing thing. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into our heads. There's actually a little bit more to it. I'll see if I have the longer one. This, I think, is most amazing. That the man of the world, even though seeing before their eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment the idea enters, I too will die. Even if it is told to them, it never enters the mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into the head. That everyone must one day die, yet everyone lives as if they were immortal. This is the greatest wonder, the most amazing thing. And it is kind of amazing. We know it. We see this everywhere. We read about it, how fragile and vulnerable we are as human beings. We read about it in the newspapers, but we don't usually take it in, that this might be me. It might have been me in that car accident. It might have been me in that building that collapsed. It might have been me that got that illness. We don't usually think that way. We may experience some kind of a pity or a sense of, oh, poor person, but it might have been us. And so this kind of reflection, it's a useful reflection, partly to help us connect also to our fellow human beings, because this kind of reflection helps us to cultivate and grow compassion, because we see that it might have been us. And so there's kind of this, almost this exchanging self for other. We see that what is happening to others might have been us. And in that, our hearts expand a little bit. Our hearts feel a sense of care and connection and openness. And so this contemplation of impermanence, this contemplation of death, in fact, the effect of it, I mean, it sounds like it might be depressing. It might be, why would I want to think about that? Or why would I want to do this? But what it ends up doing is it ends up opening the heart. It ends up connecting us to our fellow human beings. it ends up generating and growing this quality of compassion. So a lot of our suffering does result from not truly understanding this truth of suffering. So at the more obvious levels, just reflecting on this truth of impermanence can be supportive, just remembering our own mortality, our own being subject to aging, sickness, and death. Reflecting that, there's one reflection to, you know, kind of reflect that you, your family, your parents, your children, if you have children, your cousins, all your friends, that you will all die, and in no particular order. This reflection will help to wake you up, will help you to kind of land into, oh yeah, maybe I don't have as much time left as I think I do. It can really help to spur our sense of priorities. What's important to us? I think that's another big benefit of this reflection on impermanence. We don't know how long we have left. I mean, very literally, we do not know whether we will walk out of here tonight. This is true. We do not know. Likely, it's likely that we all will. I'd say the chances are really good that we will all walk out of here tonight. But we don't know. And this kind of reflection doesn't have to be depressing. For myself, what I find is it really kind of enlivens my sense of being alive in this moment. It's a sense of, you know, actually, and this reflection has sometimes come to me. Like one day I was washing my dishes at my sink and I was grinchy about something or other. You know, something was kind of annoying me about something or other, and I was kind of noticing that. And in the moment that grinchiness was there, and the mind kind of brought up this reflection of, you know, I don't know how long I have left. If these are my last moments on the planet, is this how I want to be spending them? And it was like, no, you know, and it just had such a powerful effect on the mind being willing to set aside that grinchiness. It's like, yeah, that is really not very important, actually, in the light of the fact that I could die in the next 10 minutes. That little grinchiness is not so important. And so this reflection, particularly on death, does have a strong kind of motivation and encouragement for us to really reflect on what our priorities are. What do we want to be doing? How do we want to be engaging? What's important to us? There is I've had the great privilege to spend time in Burma, getting to know some lovely beings living in the Sagaing Hills in Burma. There's an area in Burma that's just like back-to-back monasteries, and there are some. I had the privilege of helping on a retreat there for a number of years in a row, and so I went back multiple years and got to know some of the monks that lived in some of the monasteries there. One in a monastery that had a cave built into the walls of the monastery. And, you know, they're all very different. Every one of these beings is very different. But there was one who, he was in his, like, I think the last time I saw him, he was probably 94 or something. He was getting pretty old. And every time I'd go to see him, I just really appreciated and enjoyed seeing him because he was such a happy person. You know, I remember one time he was constantly laughing and playing jokes, and you know, throwing things at us and just laughing. He just couldn't keep a smile off his face. And they have this rule for monks that if you take their picture, they're not allowed to smile. These monks in Burma, they're not supposed to smile if you take their photograph. And we had asked this. There were three of us that went to visit that day, and we'd asked him if we could take his picture, and he said, "Oh yes, sure." And he could not keep a straight face. He tried, you know, he tried so hard. He tried to put his hand in front of his mouth. He couldn't do it. He's just so happy. And I understand this as being, you know, part of his practice, the way that he lived and the way that he practiced, that happiness was his manifestation of his wisdom. Happiness was what came out of him as he lived his understanding of the Dharma. And the last time I saw him, again, he was maybe 94, so he was in his early 90s. And he had been pretty sick, you know, and he looked so small. He was sitting in a chair, and he looked like this. He was just like shriveled in this chair, and he had to be picked up and carried around and moved from chair to chair. And we asked him, inquired about his health. "How are you? How are you, Sayadaw?" And he laughed and he said, "Oh, I almost died the other day." Just that same joy and delight. It was such a lesson, such a beautiful expression of that. Not depressing. It's just, oh, this is just the way it is. I almost died the other day. And so it doesn't have to be depressing. And it can be motivating. It can be joyful that we see, yeah, maybe I don't know how long I have, but I can live this moment in a way that resonates with my heart. I can live now in the way that resonates with my heart. It really takes us into now to truly understand this truth of impermanence, even at this obvious level, even at this obvious level of reflecting on our own mortality. The Buddhist teachings encouraged us to reflect on five things every day, and four of those five things have to do with impermanence. He said we should reflect on the fact that we are of the nature to age. Now this is bringing in that this is natural. It's not a mistake that we age. It's not a problem. It's nature. Like a tree grows, like water flows downhill, we age. I am of the nature to age. I am of the nature to sicken. This is being in the human body. This is part and parcel of being in a human body. I am of the nature to die. It will happen. It will happen. We will all die. This is a fact. And then the fourth one that is about impermanence is that everything that we love, we will become separated from at some point. All of our close family, our friends, any possessions, everything we love, we will become separated from. If only at our own death, we will become separated from them. The fifth thing that we're encouraged to reflect on is basically an understanding of our conditioning. It's the word in the Buddhist tradition is karma, and that's a big topic. But basically, it's the understanding that whatever we engage in, however we kind of choose to act in this world, however we choose to engage and act in this world, our kind of that shapes, let's use that language, that shapes what unfolds for us. This is one way of phrasing this in the in the Buddha's language is whatever one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. Whatever we frequently think about, however we frequently act, that tends to become what we do. If we frequently engage in or think about thoughts of being frustrated and angry, that tends to be where the mind goes. If we tend to engage in thoughts of kindness and compassion, that tends to be where the mind goes. And so this is the last reflection, is that we are shaped by our actions and our choices. Our actions and our choices shape us. Our actions and our choices can support us. And that we are the heir, essentially, of our past actions. And we are the shaper of our future actions. So it's a kind of a reflection on conditionality, on that our choices, and given that the only place that we can do anything actually is in this moment, that it's a pointer to choosing skillfully in this moment, that how we shape our minds, we have been shaped so far, you know, that our history, our conditioning has shaped us until this moment, and how we respond to that in this moment is what carries us into the future. And so this is that fifth reflection, is a reflection on karma. But four of them are about reflecting on impermanence. At this very obvious level, just reflecting on aging, sickness, death, and separation from things that we love. Just to think about it, just to put this into our minds. Because we don't tend to put this into our minds. We tend to go around with this kind of opposite belief or view that, oh yeah, that'll last, or oh yeah, I've got time, or however we tend to engage. We tend to be imputing some kind of solidity or permanence to experience. And so the Buddha just encouraged us to reflect, well, what are we? And this is a good reflection. What do you take to be kind of stable or solid? These four that he suggests a daily reflection on, they're things that we tend to, as humans, forget. We forget that we are of the nature to age, sicken, die, and that everything will become separated from everything that we love. We don't tend to take that in. But there are other things going on in our lives too, that where we tend to land, where we tend to impute some kind of stability in our lives, just to kind of reflect and take it in. Like there was one Dharma teacher who tells a story of going home from a retreat, and she had been teaching a retreat, and she went home from retreat and her house had burned down. And that, you know, that's a kind of a, you know, like I'm thinking now, if I'm just talking about this, I'm thinking about my house. And I assume, actually, there is a way in which my mind is imputing the permanence of that. I think I'm going to get there tonight. I think I'm going to be sleeping in my bed tonight. It's hard not to impute a stability to that. And so this is just an encouragement to just regularly reflect, yeah, well, I don't actually know that's what's going to happen. And again, the benefit of that is that it helps us to live more fully in this moment, because we tend to kind of project ourselves into that future moment, like I project myself to being comfortable in bed tonight or something. You know, it's like, yeah, but I'm not there right now. I'm here. Can I live fully here? Can I be here? So aside from the kind of more obvious level of impermanence, you know, reflecting on, using reflection to help us to kind of shake our minds up around this truth. there is a subtler level of impermanence that is more visible as we start to look into our experience with mindfulness, as we cultivate meditation and start to be curious about what's happening in our minds, what's happening in our bodies. So using mindfulness, we start to recognize, as we observe our experience, as we observe our bodies, as we observe our minds, we start to recognize that there's very little that's stable in our experience. And this is a pointer, again, to looking at the kind of the, what's a non-technical word? The word that came into my mind is phenomenological. the actual experience level of what's happening. I mean, there's a kind of a relative stability of our bodies, although, I mean, we even know from science, and we know that basically our bodies kind of do change. There's, you know, cells are replaced, and, you know, I hear that, like, most of our body changes every 10 years or something, 7 to 10 years. So it's like a new body. But we don't see that level of change so much. And it's like, it kind of feels like, yep, every day I look down and that like knuckle is still doing that thing. It's, you know, it's whatever it's got in there, some arthritis, whatever, it's some growth. It's not changing, you know. If anything, it seems to be getting more stiff or something, you know. So there's this kind of, some kind of a stability in a way of the physicality of the body at a kind of a, in that more, what was the word I used before? That relative level. It's kind of a relative stability to our bodies. But when we look at experience, you know, the experience of, like if you just put your hand out and feel the experience of your hand, like close your eyes and just feel, what are the sensations there? What is the actual experience of what you call hand? So you might, with your eyes closed, you might feel like some tingling. You might feel some vibration. Heat or coolness, maybe. Not to intensify the sensations. Let's just make a fist. Just feel the tightness there. Maybe you feel the pressure of the fingers in there. Maybe some hardness if you're feeling the nails. Maybe some aching. So these are sensations. Just not think about the hand so much, but just the sensation level. And then let the fist relax, but don't unclasp it. Just let the hand relax. And now we're going to explore some other sensations. So just as slowly as possible, open the hand. Just really slowly. Just as slow as you can. You might feel some kind of stiffness, or maybe some resistance, some maybe creaking feelings. Now open it quickly. And you'll find you can open it quickly. And now look at your hand. And there's a hand. And think about what hands do. They reach for things. They touch things. They drive a steering wheel. So you're thinking about your hand, thinking about the idea of your hand. What happens to the sensations when you do that? For me, at least, I can still kind of feel them a little bit because there's been some intensity in the sensations, but there's a different thing there. It's like the concept masks, in a way, the sensation level of experience. The sensations, when we were playing with feeling the sensations, you might have noticed quite a bit of dynamic kind of changing quality there. It was like very little moment to moment, very little that stayed the same. moment to moment in that. But as you look at the hand and think about it, it starts to feel more stable. It starts to feel more like a thing. And so this is what I mean, the difference between the experience level and then maybe the concept level. So so the experience level is what we actually experience. We do not experience hand. Hand is not an experience. Hand is an idea that is overlaid on experience. And so at the experiential level, when we enter into the experiential level of being with our experience, nothing lasts for more than a split second. At the experiential level, things are very, very rapidly changing. And this is another pointing of this kind of impermanence, is that we start to, in looking at our experience, we start to recognize that nothing in experience, even this table, you know, it's like my experience of this table is hardness and movement and pressure. And it, you know, it's like, yes, I take my hands away, I'm not feeling the table. Now looking at it, I'm seeing color and form and light. And actually as I move my head, there's different colors as I move my head, just slightly different shades as the head, and a different shape. So this is the experience level. And yet we live our lives very much through concept, because we need to. I mean, if I had to come into this room and figure out every time, oh, wow, that's a table. Yeah, okay. I mean, I can know it's a table like that because of the concepts and because we've learned these things. And the concepts help us to navigate experience, help us to navigate our world. I can walk across this room and not, like, walk into the wall, because of concepts, because I understand walls and doors and light and distance. All of that is concept. And yet the experience level is so rapidly changing. But we need to live our lives with the concepts. But concepts also are just something created in our minds. You know, that the concepts exist in our mind. They're very useful, but this idea of table, we share this idea in some way, but my idea of table is not your idea of table. And then not only that, my idea of table comes with my own set of conditioning around table, and your idea of table comes with your set of conditioning around table, and this is a very, you know, innocent example, but you know, this is true of everything, that whatever concepts we have come with conditioning, come with baggage. And so when we are looking out at the world, we are not just seeing things as kind of pure concepts. You know, we're seeing them in relationship to our history. And so, you know, when we come into meeting the world, much of the time we are relating to it not through our direct experience, but through this concept level, and that concept level is informed by a lot of this history, a lot of this baggage kind of that we have. And so the notion of exploring impermanence in our experience helps us to recognize essentially that our concepts are concepts, that the history that we bring with them is a history, and that it's not necessarily truth, that it's not necessarily what is actually out there. Actually, I think the experience level is closer to what's going on in the world, because it's kind of stepping below our level of concepts, the experience level of, you know, this changing, like, every sense door has this kind of what we could call elemental level of experience. And the touch sensation, it's pressure and vibration and stickiness and hardness and heat or coolness. And so the touch sensation has these flavors of experience, moisture. And sight has color, shade, shape, form. Sound has pitch and tone. Taste has sweet, salty, bitter, those things. Like, we don't taste orange. We taste tart and sweet and liquid, all kind of blended together in a familiar way that we then call orange. And so these kind of elemental sensations are, they're closer to what's actually happening in our experience. And so the pointing back into this, to see this, to begin to be curious about what is the actual experience below the level of concept? What is actually happening? Partly this begins to help us to see that, you know, what one of the things that, how impermanence gets masked for us, and gets kind of hidden from our view, is that we are relating to experience through concept. So relating to, you know, this is a table, as opposed to my sensations, or relating to our friends or families as something solid and stable, rather than a very changing, dynamic, unreliable, subject to aging, illness, death, subject to separation. We have this idea about them, and that's how we relate to them, rather than relating to them kind of fresh or new each time. And again, it's useful to have concepts. We can't live without them, but it's helpful to recognize that they are not the actuality of what's happening. And so the seeing of the nature of our experience as this very dynamic, changing experience helps us to see how we tend to relate to things through concept. And that there's often, as we start to see this too, we often start to see some of the ideas and beliefs and views that come along with those concepts and recognize, well, okay, those are just ideas. Those are just beliefs. That's not necessarily truth. And so we start to, through looking at what's actually happening here, we begin to see, well, this is what's actually happening. There's sight, and there's sound, and there's vibration and pulsing, and there's this thought and this concept that's coming up. So then we start to see that what's actually happening and what's added to what's actually happening. What's going on in our mind that's adding to experience? So adding ideas about who we are or who our friends are or, you know, what the situation means. It's like, well, what's actually happening here is that I'm sitting here and speaking and there's sound happening outside. It's a pretty simple experience. And so we can see the kind of the simplicity of what's happening and then many of the layers that we add to that. So what are we adding to experience? And so this exploration of impermanence can help us to start to kind of poke through those extra layers that we add. And those extra layers that we add to experience, that is where we struggle. That's where the suffering comes in. That's where the frustration comes in. It's the ideas that we add, the beliefs that we add, the sense that it should be a certain way or shouldn't be a certain way. That's where our struggle comes in. And so this pointing back to noticing the impermanent nature of our experience helps us to see, okay, here's what's happening, and here's what the mind is doing with that. What's the relationship? How is the mind relating to that? It likes it. It doesn't like it. It thinks it should be better. It thinks it should be some other way. It believes something about it. And so what's actually happening versus what is our mind adding to it? And so this exploration around impermanence can help us to tease these apart, can help us to see the concept level of experience as separate from the very dynamic, changing nature of experience. Let's see what else I've got here in these notes. So one place that this can be kind of interesting to explore and to start to see really how valuable it is to tease apart the difference between concept and the kind of dynamic, impermanent, changing nature of experience is in the domain of physical discomfort. So when we think about physical discomfort, maybe this is a little bit risky. We'll see how this goes. Just find a place in your body that's like not completely comfortable. It doesn't have to be like really painful, but just some place that feels a little bit uncomfortable. And let your, let your attention rest there now. And just see if you can set aside the label of any kind of pain or discomfort, and just what's actually the sensations there in that spot. Maybe there's some burning or tingling or pressure or heat or tension or ache. And let your attention just kind of hover there and see, is there a place that feels like the sensation is not changing? And if that's the case, just let your attention rest there and see, is there something in that place that feels like the sensation's not changing? Is it really not changing? Or is there some subtle, like, pressure variation or vibration, or sometimes maybe it's like, okay, if there's something, a sharp kind of place where there's something that's a strong sensation, it's like letting the attention go there, and does it stay there, or does it like move like a split millimeter to the side? So just like explore the actual physical sensations aside from the body part, aside from an idea about discomfort. Just what are the sensations? And are they changing? So I'm curious what you noticed. Just a few reports. You could just call something out, what you noticed, and I'll just repeat it. Anything that you want to share? Yeah.
My brain, when I feel supine-led transgender, so I feel the word pain, but I don't really feel it. So I don't really connect it to the sensation. So when I actually focus on it, I realize that it's pain, but like it's registered in my brain, but it's actually tightness.
So there was a difference. You understood the difference between the idea of pain and the actual sensations. Yeah, it's the concept. And so when you felt those sensations, what was the experience? Was it painful? Was it unpleasant? Or what was happening as you actually noticed the pulling kind of sensation? It was still unpleasant, yeah. But was it when you add the label pain to it, what happens?
So the feeling of unpleasantness is still there, but there's also something that is associated, like another unpleasant feeling associated with feeling, oh, I'm in pain.
Yes, exactly.
So, but that goes away because I'm realizing, well, I'm that
I but just, that's different. It's different. Yes. Yeah. Exactly. And that's an important piece to see is like when we start to look at that difference between that label of pain and this actual sensations. So the label of pain is kind of an idea and it comes with a lot of stuff. It comes with how long is this going to last and is this going to go away and is this something that's going to get worse and do I need to do something about this? Is this going, I mean, it can go to cancer in like, you know, 10 minutes or 3 minutes. It can just mushroom. And some of what we experience as struggle and suffering there that we think it's in the physical pain, but a lot of it is in our mind. Is in that idea of pain of the pain and all of the things that come with that idea, the fears and the confusion and the dread that come with that idea. And so as we start to, you know, if we can see the actual, well, this is actually what's happening and this is the concept, sometimes we can get a new relationship, essentially have a new relationship with the actual experience. And then we can recognize, okay, we don't actually have to try to convince ourselves not to have that concept of pain, but we can at least recognize it is a concept and that, you know, it can be useful at times, but wow, the mind is kind of picking this one up and running with it, so maybe not so useful. Yeah, thanks. Is there anybody else who wants to share? Okay.
Yeah. Well, I just noticed in general, particularly this time. Just in general that a physical sensation, it can seem in itself innocuous, but the reason it's really uncomfortable is there's somehow a really strong connection between it and something you have to do. And I noticed that with anxiety because when I said anxiety, it's really a very small sensation about here. And the reason it's really hard to manage is that really small sensation seems to be connected to something in the brain that is telling you that you really have to do something.
Yes.
And so it's hard to sit still. And I don't really have any control over that connection. It seems to be built in, hardwired in there.
And you can recognize, though, that you can begin to recognize, well, there's this sensation and there's this, I mean, that's essentially kind of like the adrenaline kind of thing, you know, it's like when there's it's a very tight coupling between the brain and the physicality with adrenaline. But at the same time, you can recognize, okay, there's that sensation and this urge to do and to just recognize. And sometimes you can just kind of look around and say, okay, yeah, actually nothing to do now. So I'll just ride this one out.
Do it. It's really hard. It's but so again, so today when you said so, I was thinking where, you know, I'm a little comfortable in my back, which is common when you're sitting, right? And I think the reason I don't normally dwell on it is because then when I started dwelling, it's like, oh no, now you got to change your position and you're really uncomfortable.
Well, again, that's the extra. Yeah. Right, that's yeah. The extra. So yeah, I knew it was a little risky to bring this in.
It didn't kill me. It's okay.
So this reflection on impermanence at the level of experience, it's like beginning to not only just in the first part of the talk I was exploring, reflecting on the concept, actually remembering at the concept level, yes, I'm subject to aging, illness, death. We don't often actually, I mean, we can at times know that directly, but sometimes that's more of a going in through our thought process. And then there's this other reflection on impermanence that is more checking into it in our experience, beginning to be curious about what do I take as stable in my experience? And when we do start to look at that, we usually see, so, you know, if we think, yeah, this pain is stable. It's going to last forever. It's like, okay, well, if there's something that you're taking is stable, it can be useful to observe it. What is the actual experience? Is it actually stable? And at the experience level, again, just the sensation level, it is not going to be stable. And whatever stability we put on something is because of the concept that we've brought to the experience. And those concepts, it's so interesting. Those concepts are also impermanent and unstable, but there's something in our mind that has the capacity to like hold on to a concept and create a sense of like thingness there. It's something that our minds have this capacity to do, to create the stability. And that's partly, I think, what helps us to navigate the world. So like when I look around the world, look around the room, it's like, it's not, I mean, when my mind gets pretty quiet and I look around the room, it feels kind of chaotic, because there's no, you know, when the mind is just noticing the actual sight, there's very little stability as the head turns. You know, I'm getting a whole bunch of little jumpy kind of pictures in the mind. You know, the experience doesn't feel smooth. But most of the time, our mind stabilizes that through concept and through the way our visual field works and the way our brain puts things together. It's like I turn my head and it doesn't look like the chairs are jumping all over the place. It looks like it's pretty stable. But that's a function of our perceptual processes. The actual experience is pretty jumpy. So this kind of stabilizing is a very useful function of our minds. And yet, it is really helpful to know that it's not what's actually out there. Because so much of what happens as we stabilize with concept, I mean, basically we take what we're experiencing to be kind of what's actually out there. But because concept is also shaped and is also connected with so much history and conditioning, as we navigate the world, we are relating to it not only through the simplicity of concept, but also through a lot of our conditioning, a lot of our habits, a lot of our views and beliefs. And this is not only where suffering happens for ourselves, but also where we end up in conflict with each other. Different perspectives coming in to kind of butting up against each other. Different perspectives around different concepts. And the belief that my concept is reality. My views connected with that concept are reality. And so, you know, this is actually going on all the time in our world. And this is kind of the source, the root of all of our social struggles, as well as all of our internal struggles, that we don't understand that our concepts and our beliefs are just that. They are just concepts and beliefs. So that's probably enough reflections for this evening. So thank you for your attention.